Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on July 13th, 2016. Y-Rot here with Rolo T. We're going to talk manga today.
I suppose. We could do that.
We could all just sit here and watch Nick complain about Jonah Jump's new reader, which he's trying to get the old one back.
And so he's starting up a petition to get it back.
I might. I'll do something.
Yeah, get out of here, you Dallas protesters! Nick's here, the protest is getting the old Jump reader back!
This isn't even first world problems. This is like zero world problems, I swear. So, for those of you who use Shonen Jump's online service, it's a wonderful service. Really like it. Affordable manga, support creators, all that good stuff. But they have been updating their website, Viz has, recently, and one of the changes that they made was they have now fitted the reader to the size of the window you read it in. I read manga on my laptop. That shit's too small for me to read. So, literally, in order to go through the recap today, I have put Shonen Jump on my larger monitor over here, instead of just reading off of my laptop like usual. So I'm going to be looking over here a couple of times as we go through the recap portion today. And I just want you all to know it's all Viz's fault. I've contacted their support. Hopefully they will tell me, you do it this way, you idiot.
Have you tried running the browser as administrator? You're like, I guess I haven't.
God damn it! Have you tried turning your computer off and back on? No! I never think of that.
They're like, did you try opening up the website? You're like, ow! Duh. Sir, is your computer on? You know what? That might be the issue.
I should have known that when I tried to send you an email to your support, why the words were coming up on the screen.
Why I had to write them all in a rock and hurl them. In the direction of San Francisco.
Got a very strong arm, apparently.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about manga today.
Yeah, but before we get to our normal weekly series, we do have a recommendation that we're going to be fulfilling this week for some not very suitable for Shonen Jump content. This was a recommendation that we took... Was it from Brawla?
It was from Brawla.
It was a lesbian series.
If it wasn't from Brawla, it was meant for Brawla, essentially.
It's a series called Murciélago, which is...
Machinello.
It's a Spanish word. It's okay. Murciélago means bat. There are no bats appearing in this series.
Maybe there's a bat to come?
I don't know. I'm sure that it has something to do with it being all, you know, dark. I don't know. Anyway. So, I'm not sure where to start on this, because it's a little... It actually reminds me a little bit of Black Lagoon in a way.
It's very similar to Black Lagoon.
You know, adventures of a very sexualized mercenary girl. With the twist that she is the most lesbian. She is a lesbian and she is very into having sex with girls. Like, it is her reason for existing, it seems. That seems to be her one motivation throughout the series, is to discover and seduce and have sex with, attractive women. But in the meantime, she is a hitman. Well, not even a hitman. She's like a government assassin.
Yeah, but a killer for hire who works for the police, essentially. Kind of like, imagine Hannibal Lecter's out there. It's like, oh, we'll need to find our own serial killer to help us, like, understand this guy's mind. Except they don't bring these people in. It's like, hey, go out and kill this person. Because I guess you're the only person who has a mind twist enough to know how theirs works. I don't know if that's just specifically what she's there for, but she only seems to get cases with, like, serial killers or things of that nature.
They don't really bother too much with context or backstory when it comes to Kuroko. We do get a little bit and piece here and there in terms of her relationship with her main contact in the police, in terms of her relationship with Hinako, who is her partner, and why she is partnered with her. But other than that, it's just, well, here's this girl, she works with the police, she kills targets that are too dangerous for the police to handle on their own, they're too dangerous to be allowed to continue to exist, and she kills them. In the meantime, she goes around having sex with women. And that's the series in a nutshell. There seems to be no overarching plot. The manga is divided into a series of different adventures, which is one of the reasons why I brought up Black Lagoon. There was no real overarching plot in that one. It was just, these guys go on, you know, these adventures, which last around a dozen chapters or so, maybe a little bit less, and then move on to the next one. And that's really it.
There is some fashion of a larger plot. At least they are constantly building to something, or at least building pieces that don't go away after the story they're introduced in ends. Like, the sniper who shows up in the murder party, she is continually teased then through later arcs, and I just don't think everything's wrapped up with that character. Mm-hmm. And there's almost certainly a larger thing at play, like, who was the character who said it to her? There was, I think it was the guy from the DK arc, one with Rinko, who I believe mm-hmm. said something to her about, like, oh, I have a message for you or something like that. She said she can't wait to see you again, or she loved it. There was some indication that we're going to eventually find out more of Kuroko? Is that her name? Kuroko's past?
Kuroko Komori.
Yeah, there's something more to this character. We mentioned that she's, like, obsessed with having sex with women, and she's a very silly character. An easy kind of comparison to help you understand who this is, she's essentially Vash the Stampede. Like, it's a character who's very silly and goofy and sexual. She's a more direct version of Vash the Stampede. But the same thing of, like, a silly, goofy character who you are meant to kind of get the sense that the goofiness is kind of covering up that they have a serious side.
I don't get that impression at all.
It doesn't work for Kuroko, because we see inside her mind too much, and you find out there isn't anything she's hiding. She's just a slut.
For the first 20 chapters or so, I could agree with you. But the longer this series went on, the more, you find out about Kuroko, and the less likable she gets because of it.
I never found her likable, to be honest. You just get more and more reasons to be like, oh, you're actually evil.
Well, let's start this off. The first couple of chapters go by very quickly. There is a target who, like, is a former pro wrestler. He takes a bunch of steroids. He's going on a Hulk rampage. He has to be taken out. Kuroko and Hinako, who is her driver and her leash, basically, are said to take care of him. Kuroko kills him. That's the end of that. Immediately after that, they get invited to this party. Kuroko goes to the party. It turns out that all the guests are lowlifes, basically. And the owner of the mansion that they're in wants to just purify the world by killing awful people. So, it's a sort of a deadliest game kind of situation, where, you know, this rich person has them all trapped and they're trying to escape the compound. And, meanwhile, Kuroko's mostly just, obsessed with this one kind of helpless girl who's there, thinking, I'm going to save this girl so I can then fuck her. But I had a lot of fun with the series at that early stage. You know, they go in and they have these ridiculous action sequences with these absurd death traps that Kuroko is comedically immune to, because she, it's implied that there is something otherworldly about her. She can sense death, almost. She can sense dangerous intent, the intent to kill her, and so she can thus predict anything that tries to attack her and easily avoid it. And so she's just almost dancing through these traps as they go through. It's actually a really good way of setting up the characters, because it's just these strangers who are thrown into a situation and they don't know anything about each other, and they find out about each other as we find out about them as they avoid these death traps. Unfortunately, Kuroko is really the only one out of them that really sticks around. Because some of them were actually really cool, I thought.
I thought Dagumi was awesome, the martial artist. I was like, oh, this dude's super awesome. He's just punching his way through death traps.
And all of them survive. You don't think that he survives, but he does. But all of them go away. The sniper girl, who's... I literally don't remember any names in this.
I remember a couple.
I remember Kuroko, I remember Hinako.
Rinko.
I remember Rinko. But I don't remember Kuroko's main girlfriend, the...
Shio, I think?
The president's daughter. It's just because the stories go by so quickly, so I didn't really hold on to them. Well, these characters all get introduced, but aside from Kuroko, all of them just go away. Which is kind of a bummer, because some of them were really cool, and were built. They were all very different from each other, because there were only five of them. There were, aside from Hinako, who shows up later, because there was Kuroko, there was the sniper girl, there was the professor, the knife guy, there was the martial artist, and then there was the damsel. Mm-hmm. And there was a cool dynamic between them, because they all have very different personality types. And if the manga had been like the story of like a group that they made, I think I would have been really into that. But it's all about Kuroko.
It would have. It's actually somewhat weird, because they said they introduced this group and they don't do anything later, and you're kind of like, that's sort of weird. Like, you set up a lot of these things, and I think that's why there is something building up. The fact that none of those characters ultimately have been killed permanently kind of seems to indicate to me that they're going to show up again more and more later. We've already seen the sniper girl show up a couple times since then.
The series is still ongoing at this point.
So I think there's going to eventually be a payoff to it.
Maybe.
But to, I guess, the point of Kuroko herself, she's a very silly, goofy character. 90% of the time, she's comedic. She's... Mm-hmm. And almost literally every time she's doing something, it's motivated by sex. It's motivated by, I want to have sex with this girl, I want this girl to like me so she'll have sex with me, or I don't want you to hurt her because then I can't have sex with her, essentially. Mm-hmm. And
her final, the big climax of that arc is her fighting with the millionaire's maid/bodyguard. And you just thinking to herself the whole time, like, come on, you should stop fighting me so that we can go have sex. Come on, why don't you have sex with me? Oh, stop fighting. If you do, if I have to hurt you, then it's not going to be as much fun to have sex with you. It's
a character who is really going to be, I think, the crucial point onto your enjoyment of this series. Because if you find her funny and you find her attitude and personality enjoyable, then I think you're going to have a lot of fun with this series. Because it's one that does everything it does in a big way. It's very much... You know, full of action, full of sexual energy, full of dismemberment and dark storyline and all these things. Like, it doesn't do anything half-assed. So if you enjoy those parts of it, particularly with Kuroko herself, I think you're going to enjoy it. The thing to kind of get with her is that she really, at least to the point I've gotten in reading this, there really, and I think they will tease more, but there really isn't depth to her. And I don't think you're supposed to find her an admirable character. You're just supposed to be like, she's hot, and the people she's around are hot as well. Because she does some really scummy things throughout the series. Like,
let's talk about that. Because my main problem with this series is that when it was just pure balls-to-the-wall action, high-stakes scenarios where Kuroko was still just thinking about sex, I was still fine with that. It's when stuff starts getting dark.
Well, and that's...
We're talking about kidnap, we're talking about rape, we're talking about children being murdered, and Kuroko's still thinking to herself, I don't want to have sex with girls.
Yeah, and...
That's when it starts to... when she really starts to lose me.
Really inopportune times, too.
Yeah, I'm thinking to myself, this isn't really funny anymore. There is some really serious stuff going on, and I don't want to be thinking about, oh, you know, well, Kuroko got another girl boner, dur-dur-dur.
Well, here's the thing. It's dark, but it's not really as dark. It was worn to us heavily by Brawla. Like, it's a very, you know, graphic and vulgar and dark series. It's not really. I think, you know, it's not nearly as dark as something like Gantz or Terraformars or things of that nature, because even though there are graphic moments, it's generally pulled away from. It doesn't relish in it anywhere near as much as some series. I mean, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is 1,000 times more graphic and gory than this series is. And as terms of darkness goes, it's not really that dark. It just wants to tell kind of more complicated serial killer stories. Like, every serial killer has a reason for it. And they try to add
I'm saying dark in terms of the dark, in terms of the grim dark.
But I mean, the whole thing of it is essentially a collage of stories about serial killers of all varying degrees of sympathy. Which is kind of a shame, because they actually peaked in the first story with the professional wrestler, who's like, I'm a face, I want people to believe in me, I want fans to come and cheer for me, so I'm going to use steroids to get stronger, but instead I took the wrong kind of steroids, and now I'm, like, addicted, a rage monster just has to be put down, because I'm dead to the world, essentially.
If you were a real face, brother, you would never take steroids, dude!
But I like that. I was like, okay, I get this, and I think it's kind of cool. But as you go along, those characters start to kind of they shift a bit back and forth in terms of actually being interesting in some of the sympathy build up for them. And the antagonist, I think, kind of settles my ability to enjoy arcs, more or less. Like, I kind of dug DK killer thing, because I was able to kind of get with him and Rinko. But, like, the one after that, I forget what they called it, but the Rose arc, I just couldn't give a shit about any of it.
The point of that one is just that they're crazy.
Yeah, like...
The whole point of the child abduction one is just that the guy's crazy.
Yeah. But they are trying to tell, like, some, like, oh, well, you know, he was treated with such, you know, hatred, and everyone betrayed him and all those things, but one innocent person gave it to him, and it just so happened he turned out to be a serial killer then, and used that one moment of niceness to justify a serial killer rampage. It's a weird kind of balance you had to strike between the two, because you had to deal with those sorts of stories, which, when you hear about it, you're like, oh, that's kind of weird. But then remember, it's surrounded, anytime Kuroko's involved, it's generally going to be either action of her fighting something, or humor about her wanting to fuck something.
Now, in contrast to Kuroko, there is the other main character of this story is pretty much all comic relief too, Hinako. And she provides the opposite form of comic relief, because Kuroko is constantly thinking lewd, perverted thoughts, and Hinako is basically just a child in, like, a 16-year-old's body. She is completely oblivious, it seems, to everything bad happening around her. And she's fucking adorable. I mean, like, she's kind of the exact same thing as Kuroko in terms of, if you like the humor that she provides, she's going to be the exact same through the whole series, too. But she provides a very different sort of comic relief, which is she's constantly, you know, gets, like, drawn in a chibi form all the time. It's a really bizarre chibi form, too, because she's just this kind of featureless mass with limbs and eyes and a mouth, a swirly hair bit, and a belly button scar for some reason. That's the one other feature. And she's just going around like, I want food! She goes and gets food. I want to play! She goes and plays. I want to drive my car! She goes and drives a car. That's it.
I couldn't tell you a thing about that character. I couldn't even tell you her name. She was that forgettable to me. I kept forgetting she was the main character. I was like, I kept mixing her up with like three different characters.
I don't know how you could. There is no other character in the series like her.
Not like her personality wise, but just look wise. And in terms of like, I just have stopped caring about this character.
But Kuroko is impossible to mistake for anyone else in this series.
Well, Kuroko's a 6-foot tall, giant breasted lesbian murder machine.
Right. Who looks like someone tried to make Sadako hot, kinda. with the long black hair and the weird face, but also giant tits. And it's kind of, it's weird because I find the comic relief that Hinako provides a lot more easier to swallow in this story because it comes from a place of innocence and ignorance. Whereas Kuroko is going through everything, being fully aware of all the stuff that's going on, and she still doesn't give a shit. If we talk about the cult arc, the Roses arc, what happens is she is sent in to go and rescue this one girl who has joined a cult. And so Kuroko goes undercover in there. She says she wants to join. And the first thing she realizes is, it's all girls here. It's all young girls here. And she immediately is incredibly obvious about wanting to fuck everyone. And everyone is super receptive to this. Because in this cult, it's just them. So it is considered healthy for them to be intimate with each other. So she's like, this is awesome! Just goes after, like, a different girl every night while she's there. To the point that she falls so in love with being in this cult, because there's also other aspects of it where, like, she's gotta do manual labor and stuff, but she loves doing that too. She loves every single part of being part of this cult, that she forgets her mission and why she's there. And just devolves into having sex, growing flowers, doing whatever kumbaya shit that they do while they're there. And forgets the fact that this is a cult and they might be murdering people.
Well, she doesn't
Hang on. So, later on, her girlfriend, who is like a Yakuza boss's daughter, they have this running gag where the guy insists on not being called a boss. He wants to just be called the president. But she's a Yakuza boss's daughter. She gets fed up with her girlfriend being there and not doing her job, that she goes to try and rescue her. Turns out Kuroko's been brainwashed from being there, because, like, the flowers apparently have some sort of hypnotic effect that they grow. So, instead, it's up to all the other characters to try and save the day, and they end up discovering that there is a murder pit under this cult. And the head of the cult, whenever someone graduates from it, she takes them into this underground cavern and strips them naked, because that's necessary for some reason, and has them stand in this pier, and what is very obviously in front of a large pool of blood. And they're like, what's all this blood then? And why am I standing here? And what's that squeaking sound coming from behind me? And then a pendulum scythe goes through their stomach, and the cult leader's sister comes and drinks their blood, I guess. I guess that's what happens. Bathes in it? I'm not sure.
They don't exactly
show it. So.
Oh, we're losing Nick here. Oh no! What'll be the end of the story? Nick! There we go. There we go.
Hang on.
Okay, we're good now. Go ahead.
So, they're going to kill Kuroko's mob boss daughter girlfriend with this scythe. Kuroko is still acting brainwashed, so she's no help. Fortunately, Hinako is ditzing around, on her own little adventure in this cult, and she ends up climbing onto the pendulum, and it swings, but her weight causes it to swing around the intended target and just kill the cult leader by complete accident. And that is how the day is saved. By complete accident. Kuroko did nothing. We find out later, Kuroko was not brainwashed. She was just acting brainwashed because she thought that her girlfriend would be less angry at her that way.
Yeah.
That was it!
She just wanted to get more sex, essentially.
She is an awful person!
In those ways, you can kind of see the... Like, you have to look at the series in a particular way to understand it. Like, if you look at it trying to make a serious sense out of it, you're going to end up infuriated. But if you look at it as, like, a silly, goofy series that just happens to have, like, a more dramatic plot than everything else cartoonishly is in the world, then you're going to be able to enjoy it. Well, so long as you like Kuroko. And if you don't like that humor... Like, this is a character... To put it straight, in that whole thing of, like, a house full of murders and everything like that, Kuroko enters into the final battle room ready to fight with a giant dildo. Like... It's just a stupid series in that way. Like, it's off the wall dumb. There are moments, though, that it's hard to completely divorce yourself from the fact that there's a more serious thing going on. Because there's a character, Rinko, who we find out she's essentially the daughter of a serial killer. And she's sort of heard her mom. Her mom told her that their father's a serial killer. And she couldn't react to it well. She didn't want her dad being thrown through the blood. She killed her mom. And now she's like, shit, I've killed. I'm going to be destined to be a serial killer. And it ends in, like, this dramatic way of, essentially, they hit her with a car, essentially. A lot of people get hit with cars. And she gets put in the hospital. And when she wakes
it's
up...
It's actually kind of a... That's another weird Hinako moment. Because they're, like, at an amusement park. And Rinko freaks out and attacks Hinako. So Hinako just goes, like, Terminator mode and goes and gets a bicycle.
Yeah, she steals some guy's motorcycle.
And she rides it off and goes on these incredible acrobat stunts in order to then get back to Rinko so that she can ram her in the fucking spine with it. And Rinko goes into a coma, wakes up in the hospital, Hinako and Kuroko are there, and Hinako's like, well, I got you back for that one, let's be friends now.
Yeah.
And that's it.
So... She wakes up in the hospital and she's like, I'm a murderer. And she tries to commit suicide. She tries to leap off the hospital and Kuroko stops her. And Kuroko kind of explains to her, like, look, you've killed, but that's your dad's side in you. Your mom's side in you is in there too, isn't it? And yes, there are things you can kill, but there are people you can kill for the right reason. So I don't think it's up for you to decide if you die. And, like, Rinko kind of, like, falls to the ground crying because she's... seen a new lease in life. And Kuroko's hugging her. And this is where I said, seeing into her mind fucks things up a bit. Because she don't have, like, a deeper inner thought showing Kuroko is more than her labels suggest. She's literally thinking, in 5 years, I'm going to fuck the shit out of this kid. And you're like, I want to laugh.
That is literally her exact thought. Like, yeah. She's thinking to herself, she's probably going to be really hot in, like,
like,
5 years.
Her tongue is, like, just above fondling the top of this girl's head. It's just a case of...
Every single time that it seems like there's going to be some sort of sympathetic side to Kuroko, or some more warm, caring, altruistic side to her, turns out, no, it's actually motivated by sex. There's, like, a running gag in an arc with a child abductor who is abducting these girls and killing them when he gets angry at them. This girl's been kidnapped. There's a single mom who's, you know, desperately worried that her daughter's going to be hurt. And Kuroko is trying to act super heroic around her. You know, say, like, I will do everything in my power to get your daughter back. Don't worry, we're gonna get her. You know, hugging her, patting her on the head. It's like, it's gotta be okay, we're gonna save her. And every single time...
She's like,
you just look at show her face and she's like, I'm gonna... She's gonna be so happy to get her daughter back. We're gonna say
the mom. And, the mom is who she wants to fuck. To be clear,
yeah, and she succeeds. She beds that woman.
It's almost like verbatim that the mother is explaining, like, I know my daughter's been taken. I just don't know how to deal with it. And you, like, see, like, the bubbles in the Kuroko's mind. She's like, oh, that form-fitting t-shirt's banging on her! Just like, it's weird because it's not enough of a juxtaposition throughout the rest of the series for you to be like, obviously, it's a hilarious comedy. And it's intentional, but it's a weird disconnect where I can't always completely just go with it and laugh at it because there's too much of, like, a dramatic cohesion otherwise that she is just this one weird detachment from. That makes it hard for me to, like, laugh when she just does these obscenely heinous things when someone's like, I just got, you know, my daughter's just been strangled to death. And she's just like, oh, but
how
the mom...
old's that daughter?
Yeah, but the mom's still DTF, right? What?
There's gonna be some sympathy sex up yeah. here.
She's like, funeral sex, what? I think... I can see why people love this series, because Brawla loves it, our title card artist Steve Mann told me he really enjoyed it, and I can completely see why people enjoy it, and in a way, I do like it as well. I just think that Kuroko's shtick gets tired on me. Like, I find it amusing at points, and her goofiest points do tend to make me laugh, but I think it's a character who is only really interesting because she's a lesbian. Like, this is a shtick I've seen done with guy characters before, and it generally gets really tiring as well. And this is one that eventually kind of runs its course out when it's overused in an arc. Like, that's why I think why I hated the Rose arc so much, is it was so much Kuroko in that, just constantly trying to fuck everything. And if that joke gets tiring for you, it's kind of a detriment because it's a heavy part of the series. But I don't think any of these points are necessarily bad. I think it's actually a really good series. It's just, for me, it's hard to kind of enjoy it all the time because it just doesn't connect right with me all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is... It is kind of weird because, yeah, Kuroko is essentially just the Lech, but a female this time. And I think that that is honestly, like, I'm glad that there is an example of it in manga, of just this incredibly perverted... It's like if Chizuru from Bleach were the protagonist of the story and end up getting all the girls that she was constantly talking about how big their tits were and how much she liked that. And I'm glad that there is an example of that in manga. I don't think that this one is particularly good. Early on, I did like this manga. I liked, up until the reveal of what was going on in her head during Rose arc, I liked that still. I liked just her, like, kind of being easily manipulated.
Yep, looks like we're losing Nick again. And his final thoughts, too, of all times! Nick!
I have no idea what's going on.
Is he coming back?
I think I'm coming back. I don't know why the hell Skype's connection is being shitty.
There we go. We're getting you back.
Okay. Alright. Anyway, up until the reveal of what was going on in Kuroko's head during the Rose arc, I actually liked that arc. I liked the idea that she was just easily manipulated because of how sexual a character she was. Because they actually imply, like, oh yeah, we actually brainwash pretty much everyone who comes here by having them have this very, what do you call it, pleasurable lifestyle. I forget the exact term.
Oh, Nick!
What's going on? Internet sucks today. Okay, fine. Although you going, Nick, does not help at all, by the way.
I'll come up with a code word to let you know when it's happening. I'll just scream out,
why don't
like,
you just type to me, or wave at me, or something?
Alright, I'll do the East Coast sign. I'm like, Nick, East Coast, brother, right? Let you know.
You realize that shows up backwards in your camera, right?
Then I'll do it like this. Does that work? Nah, that doesn't make sense. Nick, you're crazy.
Anyway, I liked this up until it started getting much more serious in its storylines and how much Kuroko's presence disrupted those, basically. Mm. I did not appreciate the contrast, and I thought that the humor of her presence got less and less fitting as the series went along. I liked it for about probably the first 20 chapters or so, and then it kept on going. The storyline surrounding her made it much more inappropriate for her to still be doing the same thing, and the humor wore on me, and I grew to like it less and less. I do think that there's potential to this series, though. I like parts of it, but overall, not for me.
Fair enough.
All right.
There we go. To a series we didn't like so much, but we could see the potential of, to a week of Jump that is completely devoid of any goodness.
It's, because I'm not sure. I don't know how to rank things this week, honestly. I liked a couple chapters, but not as much as I liked anything the last several months, basically. Yeah, it was a down week for Jump. I think it just has to do with the fact that we've had a couple of different series hit really high points and need to kind of recover a bit, have a little rest period, all at the same time. So that was unfortunate. Well, let's start talking about it. And Nick's going to be looking over here a lot of the time now. So we're going
to
do the
recap. I'll do this to you. I'll do this a lot so it'll look like we're looking at each other.
Yes. Yes, Chris, I agree. Yes, yes. Although it looks like we're talking in opposite directions now.
What? This, no. Hold on. It should show up, right? If I look this way.
Oh, no, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
Stop acting like I'm crazy, Nick.
Well, you are crazy. But you're right in this case. Let's do the recap portion of Week of Magarik. Goofball.
Yeah!
Recap portion of Week of Magarik. Start off with Black Clover, page 69, The Only Weapon. So, we get a bit of lore at the start of this chapter. As Noelle recites a tale of evil demonic beings who once lived in the world, and the strongest among them used forbidden magic to turn himself into a demon of incredible power and tried to exterminate humanity. And the one who stood against him later became the first Hokage Wizard King! God damn it! It was not a nine-tailed fox, it was a four-armed demon. Okay. Veto reminds Noelle of that demon, of stories that she remembered in her childhood. And Veto is super powered up right now. Things are not looking good for them. The temple around them is in shambles because of the attack that Noelle unleashed and the attack that Veto unleashed afterwards. Noelle points out that Asta was hurt really badly, and Asta says, Gaono used the last of her strength to heal me with a hoarse song, little by little. How does that work at all? How does this work? Like,
how so?
Well, her throat is bleh, right? She was communicating seemingly psychically with Noelle, and apparently also using song magic. Why wasn't she using her song magic on her own throat?
Maybe it's like Josuke in Part 4. It doesn't work on herself.
Can't use a recognize. Hmm. It's possible, yes.
She's like, didn't think of that. Dead.
Asta says, let's flatten this guy and then heal Kahono's throat and Kyoto's leg. Ignoring that whole healing magic.
Ignoring that. Hey, no one can do that except for this dude.
But he does say, well, that guy grew his arm back, so then there are people who can use magic like that. There must be. I mean, I guess. But, you know, your glass half full kind of thing wears thin after a while.
To be fair, theoretically, there could be someone like Veto out there who's just not an asshole.
Mm-hmm. We're going to find that one guy from Toriko.
Yeah.
Asta literally ruffles Noelle's hair, which makes me want to punch him in the face.
There is something inherently condescending about it.
It really is. Like, if it were Yami doing this, I'd be perfectly fine with it. Fuck, if it were Gaush doing it, I'd probably be fine with it. At least Gaush is taller than her.
The fact that he has to reach up to get to her head.
Hey, little girl, I'll...
I want to know, has a guy ever done this to a woman and it not ended poorly? Like, I feel like if I ever put my hand on a woman's head and, like, tried to utter encouraging things, I would end up with a broken arm.
You've got to have a very close relationship with that person. Closer than Asta has with Noelle, let me tell you that much. And you tell us her...
Nick, put your head towards the screen. I'm going to put my hand on it, and you tell me, Nick, everything you do is magical.
I'm going to kill you.
Oh, okay.
I'm
just going to sit on my hands. I'll just...
Asta essentially says he's going to take over things from here. Fenril is watching things and freaking out because there is no goddamn way that Asta can win. And Asta says, well, you said not giving up was my weakness a minute ago, but not giving up is the only weapon I've got, and I'm not giving up until I get my wish.
I didn't understand this line. I tried to read it a couple times. I'm trying to, like, figure out the logic of it.
You said not giving up was my weakness. Okay. No, it's not. It's my weapon. And I'm gonna be the Hokage. Wizard King.
Well, it's just like, the final line didn't add into that. Like, you said that not giving up was my weakness. But it's in fact a strength. And then, in the same line, and I'm not giving up until I get my wish. I'm like,
it does sound a little bit, bleh.
It's just kind of a, I don't know, like, it's a clumsy structure where I'm just like, I don't even know what your wish is, and I'm assuming beat Veto, but I don't know.
It's a little bit redundant, yes.
Or if it just means I'm not going to die until I become Wizard King, and this is just a different way of phrasing it. Mm-hmm.
Veto decides to, instead of focusing on Asta, to use his magic to finish off all of the unconscious people in the room. They're all taken out of the way by small threads of silk as Vanessa arrives on the scene, and she protects everyone by getting them out of the way of his magic, and she also ties up Veto briefly. But he bursts out of it really quickly, fires a huge blast of energy at them, but a portal sucks it in and redirects it towards Veto, and he has to bat it away. And now Fenril has arrived, and so both Fenril and Vanessa are going to help out Asta. Fenril says a little bit of a badass line. The juniors are working hard, which means I have to act like a proper senior. But what I like about it is we still get his internal cowardly monologue. What am I doing?
It does make me laugh every time he says something. It's just because he's trying to be such a badass, but every time it's undercut by his inner monologue, I'm like, shit, fuck! Why? I really want to see his, like, magic draft day, where, like, they've had him show off his skill, but, like, I don't know, he trips and, like, falls into a pile of dog shit, and that's when I was like, the Black Bull guy's like, I guess I'll take him, and just his, like, his world shattering in that moment.
Oh, no, why am I going with those assholes? Vanessa gives something of a pep talk. She encourages Noelle to act as their last line of defense. Says that if they take even one attack straight on, that they're done for. And also, she points out, ordinary magic attacks aren't going to work, so Asta is their one weapon. And she ties some of her thread around his hand and his sword, and says to him to give it all he's got, put his life on the line, I swear we won't let you die. And the three of them, Fenril, Vanessa, and Asta, have a bit of a badass pose together. Fenril, for once, striking a badass pose without internal monologue.
Yeah, they kept out the inner monologue from this line where he's like, I'm gonna poop myself! If I could take just a moment here and interject something. I'm seeing a lot of people in the chat, and this is something that we made as our joke too, initially, when Vanessa was introduced, that she kind of felt a lot like Kana from Fairy Tail, where it was like, I'm the drunk member of our guild.
And with the huge breasts.
Huge racks. I do feel like now has come the time that we need to stop those comparisons, if only because...
She's taking a leadership role doing something.
And we're at least seeing that there's a character here beyond being an alcoholic. So
right.
She's somewhat becoming more of a developed character, at least in Kana.
Yeah, so this was a big moment for Vanessa, I think. She takes charge of the situation. Which, I mean, when you look at the characters gathered there, it sort of makes sense, because there's Asta, and there's Noelle, and they're the two newbies, and there's Fenril, and he's a coward, so he's not going to be the one to start directing things. So she seemingly is taking the role of sort of a sub-commander thing.
It would make sense. In any other situation, she should realistically be the number two of the guild, because she's presumably the oldest member. I mean, I don't know how old Gray and whatever the weird, giant, freaky-faced guy is back at the guild. I don't know, maybe that guy would fall into it, but of the members we know, I have to assume it'd be Vanessa.
Mm-hmm. So the most senior of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the three of them work together to attack. Finro is redirecting stuff. He's also redirecting Asta. He portals Asta into behind Veto, but Veto immediately spins around, and because he can sense both Asta's aura as well as the spatial magic, so he can just sense it immediately. But Vanessa can then use her thread magic to whip Asta out of the way of Veto's counterattack. She whips him up into another portal, and as Veto is following him with his eyes, yet another one appears beneath him. Asta ends up striking Veto's chin from below with his sword. And that's where the chapter ends. Cool little sequence, honestly. With a lot of misdirection and fast movement.
I liked it a lot. I made the mention on Twitter that, you know, the heroes overcoming insurmountable odds in Black Clover is a lot more enjoyable when they do so via tactics and teamwork than when it just tends to be Asta never gives up. Like, this is something I can get behind and get invested in, because it seems like they've kind of earned this victory. You know, they used actual strategy here and then combined their powers together to form a good unit. You see, like, oh, this is what the Black Ghouls can be when they're working together. As opposed to, like, oh, we're just all individual, super awesome people. It's nice to see them working together to overcome something bigger than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a really effective, you know, kind of end of the chapter.
I did not love it. I liked a good chunk of it. Overall, it wasn't the best chapter that we've gotten from Black Clover even recently. But even so, one of the best chapters of the week from Jump, so...
It is. I think the only thing that would have made the chapter a little bit better is if Noelle still felt like she had a point to things. It just kind of...
Well, she is very obviously, now that Vanessa has mentioned that, going to end up playing a role probably in the next chapter.
Hopefully she does, because it's felt like this arc in total has been ultimately one about Noelle, so it'd be nice if it kind of ends on her as well. Mm-hmm. That's my hope. But this chapter in and of itself is really good.
Mm.
Oh, we get to talk about Bleach now! Oh, I love this chapter, Nick!
Okay.
Oh, do we have to spend time going through the pages before the great twist comes in?
Okay, so... it's Bleach 681, The End to World... which I think might be Kubo's attempt at an English pun. I don't know. So, last time, Ichigo fucking lost. Two chapters ago, his Bankai was broken by Yuhibak. Then Yuhibak drained his power, left him beaten and broken. Ruki and Renji showed up while Yuhibak stepped into a portal. This one opens up with Renji trying to stop Yuhibak from going through, but he doesn't even, like, move. Doesn't even break his pace in order to shatter Zabimaru. And then steps to finish stepping through the portal. We cut away to Hushwalt and Ishida. This is gonna be like a triathlon, Chris, because we've got one huge stupid thing that happens and then another immediately afterward, with no break in between.
I want to get to the other stupid one, though.
Well, this one is so stupid. Like, both of them deserve, like, their own separate weekly discussions. These would both be chapter-ruiningly bad on their own. So, Ishida is sitting there. He's looking beaten up. Hashimoto, of course, however, has just had his power drained. He's on death's door from when Yuhibak took all his power back. Hashwan explains why Ishida didn't have that happen to him. Did you think I was disappointed that His Majesty robbed me of my power? Quite the opposite. I'm actually honored he didn't take your power. I'm honored he chose to take my power because only I can be of service to him. Why didn't he take Ishida's power? He took Ichigo's power. Did he literally, like, I have given him the shitty shrift as a joke?
Yeah, it's the one that's not as good as what Hoshwall can already do.
So why bother?
Yeah, I'm not into redundancy.
That is the other R that I had. You yeah. see what I did there? It is the redundant R, which is why I don't use it.
By the way, the other R was actually the raw, which you probably don't even remember. Actually, go back in time. I want to make him the redundancy.
That would have probably been cooler. Grammy, make up another Stern Ritter R for me.
Oh, you all brain in a jar. Why did I give you such a powerful ability again?
Alright, so Ishida starts to stumble away, and Hoshwald says, Wait, I have something to do. Transfer your wounds to me before you go. And Ishida's like, huh? And Hoshwald says, I'm gonna die anyway, so it doesn't matter. Transfer your wounds to me with your antithesis. And Ishida's like, but... why is he hesitating?
Why is any of this happening? I don't understand Hoshwald's attitude.
There needs to be a goddamn list. Like, a top 10 list of reasons why this scene is stupid. 1. Why did Ishida have his power stolen? 2. Why didn't he think to use his power to transfer his wounds onto Hoshwald? 3. Why is Hoshwald suggesting it? 4. Why isn't Ishida immediately agreeing? 5. Why is Hoshwald suggesting this? Wasn't he loyal to Yuhabak? He just said he is honored to have his power stolen to be of use to his majesty, and he is fucking mocking Ishida for not having his power stolen.
It's that logic of you've created this character... but you don't actually have to understand what the depths of that loyalty should mean. It's like Phasma in Force Awakens, where I'm like, I don't understand why you give up the Death Star's code, or Starkiller's code. Literally, the heroes could have never won if you just refused to give it to them. If they kill you, they still don't have the code. They can't take it down. You win! Why are you giving it to them? It's the same situation. I don't understand why Hoshwald's like, you send your wounds to me. It's not even like he changed. Nothing in the scenario changed. It's not like he's earned a respect for Uryu. And you could, like, I tried to, like, explain in my mind. I'm like, alright, well, he was like Uryu before. He had that friend in Baz B, but he chose his majesty over his friendship. And maybe this is his chance to change.
But now he's just giving it back to... But he's giving up that loyalty. That loyalty which he sacrificed his best friend of hundreds of years. They were friends. They had known each other for literally like 1,000 years from, it seems, from the flashback. And he gave that up for his loyalty to Yuhabak. But because Ishida loves his friend so much, he's going to sacrifice that loyalty to a guy he hates and resents for keeping his friendship instead of choosing loyalty to Yuhabak.
It's this weird thing. Like, nothing changed in Hoshwald's attitude. Like, it's not even like when the power came down and it was taken from him. Because he beat Uryu. He won that fight. So it's not even like he could say, Uryu's friendship and his attitude overcame even my loyalty to Yuhabak. That's not a scenario that happened. It's not as though when the power was taken from Hoshwald that he's like, no, what are you doing, Your Majesty? I've loyally served you all this time. He was happy. He was excited. Like, I can still be of use. So why in this moment is he like, I know I fucked over my friend for the Majesty, and I know I'm so happy to die for my Majesty, but in my last moment, fuck it. Why don't you just do this? Is there something that could potentially help my Majesty lose more? I don't... It's just like a weird logic that doesn't seem to mesh at all.
So,
does he even do it?
Hoshwald gives a monologue which says, What is there to think about? I told you to place everything on a balance, because decisions made without weighing it on a balance, made hastily in doubt, will end up as regret. And he has a flashback to that flashback we saw a while ago, to when he met and pledged himself to Hugh Bach. Does this mean he now regrets that decision? Because he just said he doesn't!
This must have been a casualty of the shortened chapters.
There is
there had to have been a chapter.
There is no other explanation. This had to have been a product of rushing to the conclusion, because this is some of the worst goddamn writing that I have seen in Bleach. And I've seen a lot of bad writing in Bleach.
It must have been a chapter where there's a completely different exchange between them and things go down differently, and that was the way it was supposed to lead to Hoshwalt offering this. Because as it is, it really just sounds like, he's like, well, I'm dead, but in my last act, let me fuck over the Majesty just a little bit.
Okay.
But that's the stuff I was like, whatever. The good stuff's coming up now.
The scene cuts away after Hoshwald finishes by saying, you should go help your friend. As Hoshwald is lying there thinking, I have got no regrets. And then we cut over to Rukia and Orihime and Renji and Ichigo. And Rukia is just pointing out, how are we supposed to fight this? He can rewrite the future. There is no way that we can fight this. Norihime is apologizing to Ichigo because she can't use her power to fix Tensa Zangetsu. Again, Norihime's powers, which are supposed to be able to defy God, when put up against a actual God, are useless. Because. Would not be dramatic, I guess.
God is stronger than her God, I guess.
So, they're like, shit, we can't fight. Ichigo can't even fight anymore. And Renji is just like, come on, Ichigo, let's go. Just hauls him up by the arm. Because, fuck it. They've got to fight anyway. Yeah. Renji, honestly, is like the one character who is escaping this scenario with any dignity. Because he's just like, fuck it. We're gonna go fight this guy. If we lose, if we've got no plan, there's no point in playing against that guy. His power is overwhelming. But we've got to fight him anyway. And Ichigo just says, there's nothing we can do. And suddenly, a sword stabs him through the shoulder.
Who could this be?
Who could it be? Ichigo and Renji look behind them and they're like, it's Tsukishima! Oh, we finally arrived at the fireworks factory, Chris.
So I had made mention last week, I was like, somehow we have to get, like, fit the Fullbringers into this, and, like, I had best just saying, like, you predicted it! I was like, no. I thought they'd have to show up. I never predicted how stupid this they would actually be to the story, though.
So, Ginjo is there, and Yukio's there.
The clock dude's just around
somewhere.
He's not there.
He's irrelevant. He's got nothing to contribute to this.
He got lost with Chad fighting the statue! They're like the statues of fuck you, you're not important enough to be at the conclusion.
They just crush him and only him.
It's like Kira's back there too, and Kumamura. It's just every character who's not important enough to the conclusion got tied up in these stupid statues.
So Yukio, I think that's the video game kid's name, Yukio, right? He's brought Ginjo and Tsukishima there. And Tsukishima was like, well, Ginjo wanted us to help out. It wasn't my choice, but I'm going to do my part because he said so. And Ichigo's like, what are you doing here? And Ginjo says, well, I told you, Tsukishima. I didn't say we should be on his side. I told you had to repay your debt to him. Whatever the fuck that means. And so Tsukishima says, Rihime, if you use your Soten Kishun on his sword again, it should work this time. Even if the future's been rewritten with a tremendous power that can't be rejected with your ability, as long as there was a different past, you should be able to reject up to that point, because I've marked it. Wait a second! And he declares, Your sword was never broken. As Tensa Zangetsu has been repaired with Soten Kishu now.
Yes! Yes! We've reached Bleach Stupidity Zenith! It's folding back in on itself!
There is... Okay. So we've got the complete bullshit of Yuhibok's powers up against the reality rearing powers of Tsukushima's sword. In the Japanese version of Yu-Gi-Oh! 5Ds, the Dark Signers would, when summoning their Dark Sacro monsters, their super uber evil versions of signature monsters, they had a summon chant, and there would always be, as part of that chant, when darkness overlaps with darkness. This is when stupidity overlaps with stupidity, the gateway shall be opened into the world of Kubo's bullshit. This is so fucking stupid. This is so goddamn stupid. It was literally, this bullshit is so powerful that the other reality writing bullshit cannot work. But Tsukushima's can. Why? Because that was in the past, not in the future, even though his act of stabbing Ichigo was in the future!
Like, yeah, is there not a universe where Yuhibok's like, oh shit, well, Tsukushima will just use his sword and bookmark it in the past?
Well, hang on a second, because without giving too much away, I have seen the spoilers for the next chapter of Bleach. Turns out, Yuhibok did predict this!
Oh, please tell me he was just like, whatever, who cares?
So it turns out that this whole thing of his ultimate power has been broken, there's no way they can win, was completely pointless. So even in the course of, we have to get to the finish, Kubo still took the time to add three pointless chapters of bullshit, going in a circle, eating its own tail in a stupidity Ouroboros. You have wasted everyone's time. Again! For no reason!
I love it. I love it so much. Like, the moment Tsukushima came in and stabbed Ichigo, it was like, gotcha! Like, with this stupid fucking face. It's so glorious. It's so dumb! I'm so glad we waited for these guys now. Man, this was a great chapter of Bleach. I mean, it's awful. It's terrible.
We reached the pinnacle. Like, okay, Kubo, you did it, man. You can now rest easy. I know that you're probably ending the series a little bit sooner than you wanted to, but you know what? You've done it, man. You can close the final page. You can close the cover on your book. You did it. There's no go... You can't go anywhere.
Ride off into the sunset.
You're done, man. It's okay. Bleach is gonna be complete now. You don't have to worry anymore. Even if you have to rush through every single... If you've got to, just cut all those loose threads instead of weaving them back into your story half-assedly in the next 10 chapters. It's okay. You've done it. The story is finished. And when you've finished writing the story, that is when the book is complete. It's all done, man. You did it. It's okay.
I like to imagine Kubo's riding off into the sunset backwards on his horse. And he's still crying like one manly tear, like, my work here is done.
The sunset won't actually be drawn either. Aaron Rules 360 in the chat. Yes, you do. Oh God, someone noted Kufokator, I think was his name, in the chat. Noted that Tekken 101's video on this was fantastic, explaining all the bullshit. I haven't watched it yet because I didn't want to paint our reaction to this. This had to be from the heart. with no other influences of just, because you only get one chance to have one first reaction to something of this caliber. And we will never have this reaction ever again. Ugh.
It is glorious.
So nothing that Fairy Tail possibly did this chapter could possibly top this.
Well, I guess we'll very briefly have to mention Boruto.
Oh, right, you're right. Boruto actually was kind of good by comparison to everything else in Jump this week.
I liked
a lot of what happened in Boruto
this week. It wasn't bad. I liked two things it did, or one thing it did expressly.
Because it
teased up that Gaara has, like, his protege, some other kid with, like, face paint, and then we see Lee's protege, and it really, I was like, are we gonna get, like, a fight between Lee's kid and Gaara's kid? And there is one. But instead of, like, having Lee's kid look super strong, but maybe lose, Lee's kid just gets fucking clowned and beaten. Like, just, let's...
No build up.
Let's just skip right to the part where Rock Lee sucks for the rest of the series.
I actually do like the thing that they established, that apparently Gaara actually adopted these three kids. Which is an interesting thing, because there was, you know, he had the whole troubled parent situation. So I like how, you know, part of his whole breaking the cycle thing was to actually look after and properly care for these kids. Yeah. Even though apparently one of them is super grimdark edgelord. And the girl just doesn't give a shit about anything. She's just constantly blasting her earbuds. There's, like, one respectful kid in this entire group.
Yeah.
He's wearing a mask.
Yes, Dad. I'm not happy with Gaara's look, by the way. It's very
that
much like...
Clover?
It's like, yeah. It's very, like... And he looks so thin. It's very, like, creepy uncle kind of look.
Even if he had just kept his old hairstyle, he would look better off.
Or if he shaved it off completely, or kept it really short.
Dude,
it's the comb-over.
Badass bald Gaara? That would be fucking awesome.
Like fucking Sandy Vin Diesel, essentially.
He's in denial of his impending baldness, yes.
Yeah, that must be it.
I also like the stuff that we get with Sasuke and Boruto. Where he's training him to... He's throwing shuriken and stuff, and Boruto's like... Because Sasuke's trying to get him to do this really complicated shuriken toss, and Boruto's like, what's the point? Shuriken never hit anybody anyway. That's what he said. He says, well...
Sasuke's like, Tenten didn't hear you say that, did she? She was crying, was she? She will cry.
She gets really upset. But he says to him, Boruto says, what was the point? Shuriken are the Uchiha clan's specialty. News to me. But Sasuke says...
I thought the Sharingan was their specialty.
Yeah, really. And Sasuke, in response to this...
And fire jutsu. What the fuck was shuriken? They're like, it's our seventh most special jutsu.
But Sasuke immediately uses Shadow Clone. He summons, like, eight clones with it. He's like, well, this is supposed to be your dad's specialty, so then why aren't you super awesome at it? Fucking sick burn.
He actually has another line I really like from him, too, where he's like, all right... Throw a shuriken and hit that target behind the tree. And he's like, there's no way to do that. And then Sasuke, like, easily does it by throwing one shuriken, then hitting another shuriken into it that knocks the other one. And he just has this cool response where he's like, that's just one example of how to do it. There are likely countless ways. Use your own head a little and don't covet immediate answers. And I'm like, when the fuck did Sasuke grow up and mature? That's really good advice.
And when you consider the experiences that he has had, where he chose to go with Orochimaru and take the curse seal and stuff and to immediately listen to Obito when he was given a half-truth, that is a surprising sign how much the guy has actually grown.
Holy shit.
And also, the way that line was written, don't covet immediate answers, that's a cool fucking line, I gotta say. So,
somehow,
teacher Sasuke.
The Boruto series is making Sasuke an enjoyable and likable character.
If there is one thing that we can say about all this stuff post-end of the series, it has made the Uchiha look a lot better than they were in the main series. But Boruto is still using the special technology to use extra jutsus, and we see the first trial for the Chunin exam which Shikamaru is overseeing, which is just essentially like a trivia, which is in the Shinobi Passwords that appear in Volume 5 of the Shinobi Strategist Detective Story, is, you know, in the, it's a yes or no question. And everyone's like, I don't know what it is. It turns out it's all a ruse. There is no Volume 5 of it. So everyone has to choose their answer, yes or no, and immediately all of them are told, you fail! And a pit opens up beneath them, and they all fall into this black pool beneath them. And they say, they're told as they're falling, all of you shall turn black and not advance. Wah! But a bunch of them all immediately react by grabbing onto the edge of the pit. Those who don't react, some of them are caught by their teammates. And so Gaara's students, he uses what looks like a variation on Gaara's sand technique to make a carpet beneath them to catch them. I forget Shikamaru's kid's name, but he catches his team with his shadow. And I like how Mitsuki and Sarada take action, and Boruto's just fucking useless.
Oh man, we fed!
Mitsuki uses, like, his stretchy powers that he gets from Orochimaru, I guess. Sarada catches Boruto with essentially a lasso. And Boruto's like, wait, so he didn't fail? And everyone explains, like, no, the test was just to see if you would have indomitable spirits and not give up. So Sarada's celebrating. Boruto's like, oh, it was useless. Naruto sends a congratulatory email to Boruto, who is like, I can't believe you only sent me an email.
I mean, not for nothing, I do have to kind of side with Boruto on that. That does feel shady to be like, it's like, call him. You can't be that busy.
You've got phones in this universe, yeah. Right?
They're like, no, we just made VCRs and computers. We completely skipped right over telephones.
The next part of the exam is a capture the flag contest, essentially. And we see a couple of the teams fighting each other. Lee's disciple gets schooled. The Chika Inacho team manages to win. And Boruto is left on defense. He's like, hey, I've got shadow clones, so I can beat this three-man team. And they're like, we could use shadow clones too. Oh, well, shit. Should they start beating him up? Sarada is like, oh, shit, we gotta go help him. Mitsuki rushes back to assist, but it looks like he's going to be too late, so Boruto is forced to use the tech jutsu thing in order to unleash a bunch of powerful techniques in order to fight them off. And back at the opposing base, Sarada uses her Sharingan in order to find the real flag and capture it. But we importantly see that there's a guy who's spying on Boruto and actually has footage of him using it.
Which so. Presumably is maybe why he's made into a missing nin. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I keep hearing people say that the Boruto movie explains, like, all of this and more, and I just haven't worked up the enthusiasm to bother actually watching it.
Well, if we're gonna read it anyway,
why not? I'm like, why not at this point? An Ashino cameo, I think. Isn't that him with the visor next to Tenten?
I'm not sure.
Didn't he get, like, a futuristic visor upgrade, I thought?
Yeah, he's got, like, a Geordi visor thing.
Yeah, instead of the glasses. So, hey, we got to see Shino. He has no lines.
Well, that's Shino for you.
All right. So, final up chapter. Let's move on to Fairy Tale. Chapter 400...
We'll be right back.
All right. Chapter 493, White Dragnil. With a cover page that I don't understand at all. Like, seriously, this is a weird cover page. So... it's Luvia, Lucy, and Virgo. And of course it's Virgo, so she's tied up because she's a bondage kink. But they're all kneeling. I don't know what's supposed to be happening. This might be some Japanese thing I don't quite understand, but even Lucy kind of seems like things are weird. I don't know what's happening. It seems like it's like a shot of a weird porno that's about to start or something. I don't know. Anyways, last time... Irene showed up after Mira Jane had beaten her two lieutenants, and they just turned into swords, essentially. So this chapter begins with Irene being like, I see you've been taking good care of my little girls. And then all of a sudden, the swords, like, activate, and their powers re-happen again. So the one that had, like, the ribbons, basically, restrains Mira Jane up against this giant rock. And then the one that had acid fires and hits Mira Jane, and of course dissolves her skin off, leaving her this horrid third burned mess of flesh and agony. Oh wait, no, it only just burns off her clothes, and only enough to accentuate her cleavage, because that's how their acid would work. Of course, maybe that is why Kaguya didn't send Naruto and Sasuke into the acid dimension, because it would only have burned off their clothes. They would have been fine. This is the sexy kind of acid that doesn't burn everything off. Irene is mentioning, like, first I'll take that pretty white flesh and make it look as appealing as an old worn dish rag. Which, I don't understand what that even means. Then burn her with acid that you just used! She's like, you'll be a disgusting lump of meat that no one can stand to look at. It's just another one of those fetish scenes, essentially, that's always uncomfortable and weird and doesn't make sense, and it makes female villains in Fairy Tail look really stupid, because I don't know what your goal was in this. Even if your thing was like, I'm gonna brutalize you and make you look ugly before you die, because apparently that's some part of my motivation now. You didn't do it. You just burned off her clothes, which, I mean, unless you have weird sexual, like, rating system, I think you should be able to justify, like, oh, wait, that just makes her look more attractive because it shows more of her giant cleavage. Whatever. August shows up with Brandish. And August's like, oh, or Irene's like, oh, August, it's been quite some time. And Brandish is here. Haven't you grown? And August's just like, shut the fuck up. You used your powers without asking, didn't you? She's like, oh, but it was a wise tactic on my part, and His Majesty's in Fairy Tale, and I don't believe that merits a lecture from you. And August is like, fuck you. I'm the leader of the Spriggan 12. I'm not taking your horse shit. And they have, like, a little stare down. And Irene's like, fine, but this one must be dealt with. She hurt my girls. So then August fucking just fires, like, a super beam that kills Mira Jane immediately. Just fires it right through her heart. In the most badass moment. He's like, fine. Pshh, done. Let's get out of here. I have no time for your fetishy kink bullshit.
Irene's like, but I wanted to torture her.
And it literally just blows, like, right through her. Like, fucking, what was it? Vegeta to Yamcha.
Or Frieza's death beam.
Yeah, like, just, like, pew, just right through her. And that's essentially where we cut away. We cut over to a weird scene then, because now we're back in the forest with Yukino, Elfman, and Serrano, who I didn't realize was in a bikini.
She's still in that bikini from when they met up with her before.
I forgot she was in a bikini, so there were a couple shots where I was like, did she get stripped and I missed it? Considering everything else that happens in this chapter, I wouldn't be shocked. But, essentially, it's just a dumb scene that gets a lot of focus, despite the fact that I don't think these characters...
It's a lot of time.
No, these characters aren't that interesting. Essentially, Serrano doesn't want to admit that she is Yukino's sister, because she feels bad about what she's done. And she essentially comes to the point where she's like, no, because I have a little sister who's in the world of what's good and right, and she can't have a sister commit terrible crimes, but, you know, one day, if my crimes are atoned for, then I can hug my little sister again. And it's just like, okay, this might be a fine story, but you should have maybe saved it for characters we care more about. Like, on the list of things I gave a fuck about in Fairy Tail, Yokino's long-lost sister was a very small part of that. I cared more about the fucking square-faced priest and the square-faced gangster guy being brothers. We then cut away, and I need to make mention of this, because in a week where Tsukishima used his past bullshit sword to make Ichigo's sword bullshit, there's still one piece of bullshit in this week that was close to that. So, Mira Jane wakes up, because it turns out she's not dead. She is not dead because Brandish shrunk her wound, which her enormous breast covered up so no one realized she was still alive. She literally, like, lifts her fucking boob up and is like, oh, the wound's not bad. It's literally a plot point now. The stupid fan service has become a plot point in this series.
You can't choose to not look at the boobs now because then you won't be able to see why she's alive.
I want this scene in the anime. I want to see how they animate it because it's so dumb. And you have to look at it. You're like, I don't... Like, she has to make that stupid, goofy, like, bloop sound effect that can only sound comedic when it happens, when she lifts up her boob to be like, oh, the wound shrunk, so... And thank goodness my boob covered up that it shrunk so no one could see that it had... It just sounds really... It's really dumb. Mary Jane's fine. Again, thank God we had a whole 6 pages of dramatic tension as the...
Thank God that Lisanna was... Thank God Lisanna was there in a tiger print bikini to see that she was okay, too.
She's done nothing. This series will end with her accomplishing nothing. We cut away to Di Maria, who is trying to escape. Last time we saw her, she had been tied up to that chair in the fairy tale prison. And I guess the chair didn't come with her, but the ropes and things did, so she's still, like, bound up. And some people found her. And shockingly, considering the world of fairy tale, they're not, like, slave traders or BDSM fascists or, like, some other kinky thing. They're actually just good people who are just like, hey, you're a bad person. We're not letting you get away. But then they say, oh, it feels nice. Like, they get covered in this white glow. And, oh, it feels so good. And then they kind of, like, die. I guess their souls are literally leaving their body, it sounds like. Some guy says, white souls, I release you to fly free into the heavens. And the next time we see the guys, they're just laying slumped on the ground. So, presumably, this person can actually take and release souls. And we find the last member of the Spriggan 12, Lacarde Dragnall. So, dun dun dun, he's Natsu and Zeris' brother, dun.
Rather sudden reveal there. Like, no build to that at all.
There may have been a tease to it at some point, but I really just don't care. Like, at this point in Fairy Tail, when there's so little left to do, why introduce this character? Like, unless he completely shifts the relationship between Natsu and Zeref, what's the point? I mean, he has, I guess, soul powers? I don't know. It just seems like a really weird twist. It's dumb. It's a really dumb part. Maybe
it was a very, like, not noteworthy chapter, honestly.
It was just stupid. Like, it's just plot points that didn't need to happen, and a lot of really shameless fan service from the opening cover to basically the end. Just a lot of cheesecake that is kind of fairy tale in its words. And yes, he could technically be also the father, he could be a cousin, he could be a lot of things. I'm going to assume brother, since Natsu and Zeref are already brothers, and that seems to fit into that relationship well enough, and he seems to be in that same age range. Who knows? I don't care. I legitimately can't see a reason why this character need to be introduced, but hey, I guess there had to be 12 members of the Spriggan 12, and might as well make the last guy important.
He's also a Dragon Slayer.
I don't know if he is. I mean, I guess he could be. Soul Dragon Slaying? Who cares?
All right, let's move on. Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 174, The Salmon That Swims Through Time. So, last time, Soma and Alice and Kurokiba seemed to have discovered a method for their group to pass the first portion of the winter festival test thing. And they head off, and after they've gotten their salmon, or to go and find it, various ingredients, and so on and so forth. Their instructor is tasting various dishes, and they're like, "Yeah, you did it!" And they're like, "Yeah, we totally accomplished something. Yay, we passed. Yay." Pardon me. There is an important moment. Amongst all this, where they're discussing, some of the students are discussing what to do, and they're like, okay, we need to cut it like this, right? Yeah, okay, and we have to put it in consomme, heated to just below the boiling point, let it diffuse for 20 minutes. And next, wait, hold on a second. Aren't we supposed to fan with cold air? Yeah, you're right, we should do that. Wait, why do we have to add more stock? Because Dina Zombie said to.
And I like that panic look the person has, too. Like, he said so, do it!
Yeah. And Erina is observing all of this with a stern look on her face. But very good, Zoe. Good job. You're making robots. The instructor is acting evil for a bit, that they've only got 30 minutes left and they'll fail! But then Soma shows up. He's got an ice box under his arm, and so she's like, oh, you found your green, huh? Well, let's see what stupid little fish you managed to find, and they pop it open, and there's this awesome-looking salmon inside of the ice box, and they're like, wait, what the fuck is this? And they explain that it is a Tokishirazu salmon. There's a long explanation that follows about when fish are in season, when they are not, and so on and so forth. Tokishirazu are salmon caught before they have fully matured, as the bodies have yet to produce roe. All in the nutrition,
though. Can we abridge this really quickly? Instead,
spread throughout the fish's entire body. They are caught well before the season's done, and they're frozen, and so on and so forth. There is a brine freezing method, which Alice breaks down and explains in terms of how chemicals and temperatures interact with each other. They managed to find a company that uses that method in order to preserve fish. They managed to find the fish. Yes. They've got a good salmon.
It took a while. They found a good salmon.
The professor is still thinking to herself, well, they've only got less than half an hour to prepare it anyway. There's no way you can possibly prepare it. It won't change the outcome of the test. Alice and Soma and Kurokiba are awesome. They make the fish.
I'm a little bit bummed, because I kind of was hoping... I guess they're going to maybe stay as a team going forward. I don't know if they're going to keep the team, though, because I was kind of like, oh, I was hoping like this three-man team would go on a little bit more.
I do like the one little note that they have where Soma is going to invite the professor to try it, and Alice just cuts him off and like, go ahead and dig in! And they get in each other's faces over it. Or rather, Soma gets upset about it, and Alice is like, what?
I like that. Sorry, go ahead.
You go ahead.
I was just saying, someone in the chat said I really lick Alice as a character. So I typed that same thing. Like, I also really lick Alice as a character. And just all the chat's like, you're disgusting. I'm like, I think they may have missed me making a comment on someone else doing this.
Chris never makes makes weird, dirty comments about characters. They pass. Yes. It's a tasty dish. And aside from just, you know, lying about the quality of the dish, she's got no choice.
Kind of weird. There was not a lot of fanfare to this. Like, even the dish they created didn't have really anything presented to it. Here, bite, done, you win. Like, not even like a scene where, like, it make her clothes rip off because it's so good. Like, I thought the logic was, now just make the dish that Azami taught you and you'll pass. And the logic being, make the dish Azami taught you. So if someone presents a dish that's different, then it wouldn't automatically pass. It would have to be like the Aizen challenge, where like a judge has to be unable to make the other decision because the food's just that good. But there isn't that element to this. It's just kind of she eats it and she's like, this is really good, I'm done.
I think that instead was they provided quality ingredients to the kids who were, you know, going along with things. They knew exactly what to do. So they just did that, knowing that method would produce a quality dish, given it had quality ingredients. So, because they were put at a handicap, Soma's group instead had to come up with something more creative in order to pass. It's not as big a deal, but consider that they've got like five more legs of the test to go through, and I think that this just provided, you know, valuable setup. You know, establish that this is the kind of thing that they're going to have to go through. We can raise the stakes from here, and then we could have it be much more dramatic. I don't think that every single leg of the journey has to be made a huge deal of.
That's why I'm hoping they stay as a team, so we can kind of get more out of that group, because it seemed like a lot of fanfare for something they solved in one chapter.
I could see that, but we'll see. Let's move on to My Hero Academia. Time for a couple of filler chapters.
It's been a while since we've had these.
We've had some really... Yeah, it's been quite a marathon with My Hero Academia. Just plot development after plot development. Lots and lots of long action sequences. I think that going into last year was the last time we had any sort of real break. When they were, like, in the training camp. Because other than that, it was just they're in the hospital, but they're planning on going to go save Bakugo.
Yeah, like, those two arcs connected into one another almost immediately. And I was thinking, like, maybe there was that brief chapter where they, like, go shopping after the Stain arc. But I was like, that still ended with Deku meeting Shigaraki. So even that one kind of had a lot of full speed to it. So I don't know. It's been a while.
So, assuming them checking their rooms out does not lead to them discovering the spy who then tries to kill them all, I think that it's safe to say that this is going to be
What's this phone that says evil Shigaraki calling phone for I am the spy? And he's like, Zoinks, you found me! I shouldn't have hit it on my pillow! Not underneath my pillow, but on it!
DTA, don't trust anyone. That's Stone Cold Minator's philosophy. Anyhow, so everyone's moving into the dorms in this chapter. Number 98, moving into dorms. We get a little bit of a reflective moment from UA's president, thinking to himself, you know, this isn't just to ensure the student's safety. This way we'll also be able to potentially deal with a mole by having them, you know, closer to the chest. He's, you know, thinking about how worrisome it is, you know, the public investigation going on, suspicions that they've got, and how they're in a really weak, vulnerable state, and hopefully this change will allow them to slowly recover. And also in the meantime, they're going to present their students with prospects of a bright future. Before the students move into the dorms, Aizawa addresses them at the gates of the dorms, and he says, okay, you know, we wanted you all to, you know, be able to earn provisional licenses with the training camp, but we kind of got interrupted. In the meantime, Todoroki, Kirishima, Midoriya, Yayorozu, and Ida, you guys headed out to rescue Bakugo on that night. And the rest of the class all look at them in shock. They had no idea that they actually went through with the plan despite knowing about it. And like with the last chapter where we got to see the entire class, I like this one because it lets you see the little differences in their reactions. Like Uraraka and Ashido look kind of hurt by this while most of the class looks shocked. Except for Tokoyami because he's a bird and it's hard to read his expression.
Well, and because he's the master of darkness, and you guys can't understand my soul, and crawling in my skin, that pain just will not
stop. It's the awesome. More we learn about him, the more of a joke he becomes.
He's like, so funny, though.
It's so funny.
The moment you see his room,
it's so great. But Aizawa says, you know, this is really serious, and he says that if it weren't for All Might retiring, he would have expelled everyone in the class, except for Bakugo, Jiro, and Hagakure, because they're the only three that didn't know about the plan. Because the five of them, of course, actually went out into nature themselves, but the rest of the class didn't report that this was going on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were accessories, essentially.
Now, which ones are Jiro and Hagakure?
They were the two. Jiro is the earphone girl, I think. Hagakure is the invisible girl.
Okay. That's right, because they were the two that were injured in the attack.
So they were unconscious, and that's why they didn't know about the plan. I believe that Jiro is the girl. Maybe Jiro is, God, I forget, because they didn't get to do much, so. Hang on, I'm going to look it up real quick.
People are saying
Jiro is the Jiro, I was right, it's Kyoka, yeah. So yeah, they didn't know about it. That's why they wouldn't have been expelled. And Bakugo was, well, kidnapped. So he didn't know about it. But he says, you know, the 17 of you, you betray our trust by, you know, not reporting this. No, but look, if you just follow the rules from now on, if you behave properly, you might be able to regain our trust. And he's very, like, I am disappointed, son, kind of approach to it. And then he just turns his back and walks into the dorms. He's got no more to say about it. He dismisses them all. And there's a weird kind of moment where Bakugo looks over at Kirishima, who's looking down on himself. Bakugo grabs Kaminari, drags him into the bushes, and there's a bzzz sound effect. And Kaminari emerges doing this. I'm not sure exactly what happened. Did he do something that forced him to unleash his powers? What?
I forgot how his powers exactly work.
Yeah.
I know it's like, what's his name? Kaminari? Is that Kaminari. It? Alright, I'm gonna look this up.
Because it's a Japanese lighting.
Because I had to remember essentially what his... Well, I mean, he could rob him, but I thought there was like a downside to his power, I'm trying to remember.
Bakugo then gives Kirishima a bunch of money. It's to...
I don't know.
It's to repay him for the night vision binoculars. I still don't know what the fuck's going on with Kaminari.
Well, I know he gets dumb when he uses too much power. Like, right. that's the joke, is he, like, when he short-circuits his brain. But I guess Bakugo beat up Kaminari to get the money to pay back Tetsu's rival.
I don't think that's it.
Why does he take him in the bush and beat him up?
I think that maybe he was doing it to interrogate him, to find out what was going on. I don't know.
Would he have known about the...
Well, because Kirishima then says, how'd you know about this? And Bakugo just says, word always gets out with so many idiots around.
I guess that works. I don't know. It's confusing to me.
Yeah. Anyhow. So, that relieves a lot of the tension, though. The fact that they, you know, Kaminari's, you know, all brain dead now and is stumbling around. He's making a bunch of the other students laugh.
Yeah.
And the rest of the chapter is, now everyone shall move into the dorms. We get a little bit of a breakdown from Aizawa in terms of, okay, you know, the first floor is a common area, and then you've got, you know, shared dining hall, baths, laundry rooms here. Guys are going to be on this side of the building. Girls are going to be on this side. You're going to have, like, 3 to 4 kids in each hallway. And Mineta's like, did you see the baths and laundry area are common? And Aizawa says, they're separated between boys and girls. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
They all move in, and it's like, oh, yeah, cool, awesome. And I forget.
Everyone's hanging out in the common area afterwards. And then Asha says, what if we all, like, look into each other's rooms? And they're like, what do you mean? And they just decide to do it. And so they go into Deku's room. He's got all this All Might merchandise. And they're like, oh, you're such an otaku.
You're such a nerd.
So...
I love this. They see Tokoyami, and he's just like in front of his doors, arms crossed.
This is completely childish and ridiculous.
No, nothing to see here. And they just push him out of the way and open up, and he has...
I like how Hagakure is one of the ones who pushes him too. So you just see like a pair of pants and t-shirt trying to push him out of the way. And he's still desperately trying to lean against the door, casually, to keep them out of it.
It's the best room.
It's completely dark in there. There's black curtains, multiple leather jackets, multiple black hoodies hanging on the wall, random bat wings, a fucking sword and shield,
skulls. This is the dude who, when he plays Overwatch, he doesn't just pick Reaper, he role plays as Reaper as he's going through.
I'm the dark man turned into something evil. Now I'm gonna shoot you in the back of the head, you talking monkey.
I love the middle panel on this page. It's Kirishima says, I remember buying keychains like this in middle school. This is the most...
Like, you really... I want to walk into the room and you just hear Linkin Park playing or something.
And not only does he tell them to get out of his room, he says, be gone!
Like, oh man, you're such a fucking weeb.
They go into Aoyama's room next. He's got fucking disco balls.
Yeah, I like how it's just all shiny and everyone's like,
yep.
Yeah, what is exactly I expected. And he seems a little almost disappointed by that. Like, he's just like, wait.
So then Uraraka says, is there anyone else left on the second floor? And Mineta is poking his head around the edge of his door. And he's like, come on in. I got something to show you. And they're like, now let's go to the third floor.
It's almost terrifying. Like, what was he going to show them? What's in his room?
I kind of want to know now. It's one of those things where it's like your imagination fills in the gaps far more horrifyingly than the action, anything like, that you could have drawn.
Was Mineta about to sexually assault those girls?
Slash those guys.
Yeah.
They go into, oh gosh, I've forgotten his name, Tail Kid's room.
Well, they go to Ito's room, and it's like, everything's super... Wait, they go to Ujiro's first. Yeah, sorry, I forgot it because it's one panel.
Ujiro's room is, like, completely featureless.
Yeah.
And they go to Ito's room, and he's, like, got class books everywhere. But Ito's proudly presenting them. He's like, there's nothing out of the ordinary here.
I love that he has a glasses collection. It's so dorky, but I don't understand it.
He explains it. I expect to go through many pairs during our intense training. He's prepared for them to get cracked and down, so he's just got an entire rack of glasses. He's like, there's nothing unusual about this at all. What are you talking about?
This is like, there's so many losers in this class.
Well, and we see as they're continuing on through the dream that Ashido and Uraraka have just stolen a pair of one of his extra pairs of glasses and are just wearing them for fun. Kaminari's got games everywhere. Koda's got a bunny because
he's cute. He talks to animals and like he's kind of like the Martin of the group, like a little bit, you know, boyish and innocent.
As the chapter winds down the next two pages, though, Mina is like, you guys gotta the girls should show us our rooms too. It's not fair that only the boys do it. And he declares that this is a competition now. It's to decide the best interior decorator in the class. And everyone, because this, I love this, the split screen that goes on in this page, because at the bottom, Deku is super determined. Ashido is like, this is a great idea! And Kyoka's like, I don't know about this. The guys are looking determined. Then it cuts to fucking Kirishima.
It's like who's picking their nose, looking at the phone.
Looking at their phone. Todoroki doesn't care. Bakugo's just in his room sleeping. This is so fucking funny. Because half the guys are like, this is a competition! And the other half is like, what's going on? I don't care.
Like, it's so dumb, but I guess I love it for that. Like, it's a silly, stupid, funny chapter, but it's nice to get that. And it does help to continue to build the dynamic of the class. Like,
the bonding between them.
I never would have assumed prior to this that Tokuyami was that much of like a fucking weeaboo dickhead. Like, just like, I'm too dark for any of you. You can't understand me. Alright, Batman, I get it.
The darkness that dwells inside me.
It's going to unleash it on all of you.
It's like, he's got like middle school syndrome, but he actually is special.
Yeah.
It's so good. Yeah, this is actually one of the best chapters of the week, despite the fact that it's not incredibly exceptional from the last few chapters, as a combination of it was actually really funny, and not a lot to note from a lot of the rest of the chapters in Jump this week.
No, it was kind of weird, because when I put this chapter, my like Reddit, I immediately put down, like, well, My Hero won't win this week. And I got to the end of the chapter and was like, all right, maybe it will. Like, it's at least funny. I mean, that's something that's going for it.
Mm-hmm. Isekoi, Onoderic Investoraku, it is a big deal, but that's really the only thing that happens. I do like the way the chapter closes, because there's this big two-page spread after of Onodera actually confessing, and then Raku thinks about some of the interactions they've had over the last couple of years, and now has this new context that she's actually loved him this whole time. And at the end of the chapter, he just starts crying. And I actually really like how emotional it gets at the end of the chapter. As they realize that they have loved each other this whole time, and the other one never knew about the other's feelings, but for years they've never confessed. And you gotta think, you know, it's like, oh, you know, how different would these 3 years have been if one of them had confessed to the other? Could they have been happy together over these 3 years? How many memories together could they have had? How differently would things have turned out with their group of friends, and so on and so forth. And,
whatever, girl two.
Yeah, well, I mean, Onodera has always been, like, my least favorite of Raku's main love interests. I don't consider Yui to be a main love interest.
But she had a key, Nick!
Literally, like, out of all the girls who have, like, fallen in love with Raku, like, the six of them, I think.
Because
there's Chitage, Onodera.
Onodera's sister.
Marika, Sugumi, Haru, and Yui, right? I don't think that there's anyone else. And if they are, they're not really important.
There were some Maya. Yeah, I think that was mostly it. There's other girls, like Paula McCoy, but I don't think they were really presented as love interests or anything like that.
Out of those six, Onodera has always been, like, my fifth favorite. Because Marika's more entertaining. Sugumi I actually really like. Haru is a lot more sympathetic than Onodera, honestly, I think. She's more interesting. Yui's terrible, but she's Yui. But I did really like this chapter. And there's a lot of ways I think you can read the reaction that Raku has. One of the ways I think might be, oh, well, Raku has already decided on Chitage instead of her, and that's why he's upset, is because he knows that he's going to disappoint her. But I think that, honestly, just the in terms of the, they could have had 3 years together, and they didn't, you know, and they're just, and then also they're just super emotional because they realize that they've loved each other. But, you know, helped along by Komino, she's really great art, as always. I like the chapter overall. There's just not a whole lot to talk about, because it's one big dramatic moment for a character that I don't really care too much for.
Yeah, if it were maybe, I'd have a lot to say when this was the Chitoge, you know,
well, we confession. Did have a lot to say
it was that's what I mean. That's what like, I had something to say with
when
that.
When it was like Raku realizing his feelings for Chitoge, we had a ton to say about that.
It just, to me at this point, it really feels like it's a foregone conclusion that it's Chitoge. Like, so much emphasis was put on that, that this is kind of like, I have to pay my due respects to the Onodera thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it doesn't mean as much now, because it feels like there's been so much put into the fact that the Chitoge relationship seems like the winning one.
Hell, I had more to say about Sugumi's thing, where she didn't confess to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
it could definitely change. I'm saying my perception of it. Let's do Toriko.
Yeah, One Piece was off this week, which is another one of the reasons why it was not a great chapter.
And as a bummer, World Trigger's off next week.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Back to that part of the year, apparently, where World Trigger and One Piece can't be in the magazine together anymore. It turns out Oda joined Team Valor, and Ashihara is definitely Team Instinct, so refuse to be in the same magazine.
I don't understand those factions. What is going on with Pokemon Go?
You just pick a team, and they're really arbitrary. It's colors, and they each represent one of the legendary birds. So I picked Team Instinct because it's yellow, so Zapdos. But that's like, your team has a leader too, but you only see a silhouette of them. And some people are like fervently on the red team because they have their, it's a chick as the leader, and they're like, she has boobs. And I'm like, but you don't see them.
Why do you care? Moltres sucks!
Moltres does suck. All right. So, there is... The chapter begins with brunch in Aimaru. I really don't care. I really don't care. Then we get stuff with Otake continuing to prepare God, and a little bit of insight into his backstory of what he and Komatsu and the other one were training. And
it's really funny you say that, because it's such an afterthought even in this flashback.
He really is. He just thinks, oh, you were there too.
Yeah. Like, he's
he doesn't
saying,
even think
like,
that until he shows up in front of him.
He's like sitting there working. He's just like, God, I put so much hours into becoming a top tier chef. And I think, oh man, I've been here for 14 hours. I should take a break. And then I walk down the hall and I would see you practicing, doing such beautiful cuts on an ingredient I was struggling with. So I said, no, I won't lose to you. And I'd go back to work. Da, da, da. And then I went a little bit further down the hallway, and the other guy was doing the same thing. So I guess that motivated me, too.
Which is a shame, because the whole thing, this whole flashback that Otake has is actually really cool.
Yeah.
I like that this insight into their relationship, into their nature as rivals, but friendly rivals. And then, yeah, you know, he's preparing God, and he thinks that he hears Komatsu from within God also preparing as well. And he, you know, shouts it out, like, you know, I know I'm not alone, I'm not preparing God alone. And then suddenly Ume is just there. Yeah. He's just like, that's right, I'm here too. And you're like, he's like, oh yeah, he was there too also, really. it's such a Toriko thing to turn a potentially really dramatic thing into a joke.
It's, but, well, it's kind of weird, because like, for a long time now, it's been built of the idea that there were three members of this group, because they all filtered into different factions. Toriko, like, Komatsu was with Toriko, Take went with Midora, and then Ume was in Neo. So each one of them was in a different faction, so, like, it was kind of interesting that way. But Ume's just, like, this forgotten character who they never really talk about. It's just like, here's another thing with food luck.
Another guy who looks a little bit like Komatsu, but isn't him.
Yeah, it's, like, weird, because Take and Komatsu actually have had, like, a relationship and conflicts with one another throughout the story. Whereas Ume just, like, keeps showing up, and it's like, oh, right, the third guy. I love you, too.
And he has this whole thing where he's like, yes, we're going to show the world's greatest ingredient the fruits of our training. By the way, when did your hair get white? Like, in the same panel.
Yeah.
We get some of the fights between Toriko and the Blue Nitros. Terry and comes in to help out. We cut over to Zange, who is watching things proceed from far away. And then Gigi shows up in a super muscle form. He says he has something to eat, or someone to eat, and that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird conclusion. Like, I did find it kind of funny that the animal showed up and Zonge's on their back, and it's like, Zonge, like, I just feel like I walked into the final boss battle. I can even hear the music, and everyone's like, you're hearing the boss battle music? Like, it's funny there, but it's just kind of weird that, like, Gigi shows up and is, like, super huge, like, I got food for everyone, chapter ends.
It's a weird all-over-the-place chapter.
I guess you have to put him in here, because if this is the conclusion to Toriko, or at least the conclusion of everything that Toriko's been built up to at this point, then you have to kind of include this character, but it's just, like, I don't know, just doesn't feel that important, because there's so much other big stuff going on right now, and other more important characters we want to kind of see more of.
Alright, World Trigger.
World Trigger!
Chapter 150, Tamakoma 2, Part 15. Info dump. Another info dump chapter. In terms of how the rest of Tamakoma finds out what's on at the meeting, what they're going to have to accomplish now. They established that Tamakoma's next match, they're not going to have Husei available for it because it falls basically on the same day as his induction into Border. And so then they go over, but actually, side note, I like, once again, Husei with his best use of chopsticks ever.
The Glock. Dragon chopstick.
And Konami just bops him on the head at one point. like that. They go over what their opponents are going to be next time. One of them is going to be Ikoma Squad, led by Ikoma, and also Oji Squad, led by Kazuaki Oji. And so they establish the differences between the two groups, and we also cut over to the groups in their meeting sessions. And we find out that Ikoma's thing is that he calls girls cute. It's actually way funnier than it sounds.
Yeah, it was actually pretty funny.
Because they're talking about Tomoko and Sue. It's like, okay, yeah, we gotta. He says, because they say, like, all right, we gotta stop that Kyuga guy. And one of their attackers says, well, I also use the grasshopper, so I'll stop that guy. And Maori is their operator, and she says, okay, guys, you know, frontliners, we just gotta stay cool, or they'll, you know, break us down and get us. And Ikoma says, yes, but we also have to keep an eye on that chick from Tamakoma 2. She's small and cute. And they're like, wait, that's what you're talking about her for?
I love this guy. He's essentially like a Digimon protagonist, just in World Trigger. Like, he has the stupid goggles, and they show a montage of his finishing moves, and every time he's staring at the camera, and they're like, why? And he just has this face that's so serious. Like, I expect a little fucking Agumon to show up. It's like, yeah, you get him, OG! And, like, it's like, that's not my name. Like, whatever!
And they do a little joke where they're like, oh, Iko, you're always saying girls are cute and stuff like that. And their operator's like, he's never said that about me before. And one of their members is like, she's making a face that says that you've never said that about me before. And Iko was like, what? No, you're cute too!
I love it, and they all start doing it, like, what? No, Mario! I don't know why he calls her Mario, I guess that's their nickname for
her. All of them that call her that.
They're like, Mario, you're damn cute, too. Like, yeah, you definitely got your cute points. You're so cute. And she's like, you're all annoying and gross, stop it! I like Mario, which is now my name for her as well.
And they're like, yeah, well, it's okay, though. We know Amatori's lead bullet trick, thanks to Teruya exposing it. And Iko was like, yeah, she's cute too. It's not that he's got a one-track mind, it's that he is so goddamn serious about it. Because he's got really sharp eyebrows, and he's making this serious expression every time he talks about how cute a girl is.
It's such an an amusing character, because it's just got, like, the big poofy anime hair, too. Like, it'd be different if he had, like, a bowl cut, and it was that, too. It's just, like, it's like he's aware he's the cool, like, trying to be the coolest dude in the room, but he can still only talk about how cute girls are.
Then Tamakoma switches to talking about Oji Squad, and he mentions that all their members use a hound, even their attackers use it a lot, and their captain uses a Kogetsu in his left hand, and a scorpion and hound in his right, so he's very tricky. We cut over to Oji Squad talking about stuff. Captain Oji says they're going with Cityscape A. And so the other members are like,
dude, one's like, that's like a normal place. And then slightly more interesting looking dude's like, calm down, boring guy. He has a plan, I'm sure.
None of them are saying girls are cute, so they're instantly far more forgettable.
Yeah. And the only dude who's going to be any importance on the team's like, Tamakoma, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, you know what, Nick? I think OG will also make it onto the Away Squad team, because I need people on that team.
Because one of them objects, like, well, what about their wire strategy? Because it's a normal place, and we should look for a way to counter it. But he points out, well, look, if you have an open field to avoid wires, you get shot by a lead bullet. If you go for a complicated location to avoid sniping, you're in a wire zone. They're going to try and get a geographical advantage, make their opponents try too hard. So I'm just using this map, because that way we don't take the bait, we don't get caught up in their flow. That's it. And they're like, okay.
Yeah. Done. End credits. That's the
really
chapter.
Really weird anti-climax to the chapter.
I mean, it's a funny chapter. It's amusing. It's nice to see these other characters. Something I didn't realize before, Nick. I didn't realize, like, I knew they were adding Husei into the squad, but I thought the logic was, well, we'll add Husei to the squad, and we'll just put one of our members as inactive when we go into the match, because you can only have three people. Apparently that's not the case. You could just have a fourth person, which is kind of weird.
That doesn't seem fair at all.
Well, it's just like, why hasn't anyone else been doing this? I know that, like, the logic is like, well, you create another point for another team to potentially take, but, like, as long as they're talented, that's a huge, just fundamental increase in what you can do.
It's a weird mechanic, and it doesn't speak of fairness very well, does it?
I have to imagine it's going to come up and be addressed, and they're going to talk about why it's not used. But
maybe
it definitely,
there are three-member and four-member matches. I don't know.
I think
maybe Tamako has only been three-on-three-on-three-on-three, etc., because they only have had three members. And maybe if you have a fourth member, that option is available for teams to provide a fourth member. I don't know.
It's just tough, because, like, I'm thinking of, like, I'm thinking of it in, like, an almost, like, a game form, where I'm just, like, you know, if you're playing, like, an RPG, and you could have a party of three members, and you're constantly fighting other three-member parties, or you could just add a fourth person, it's just like, well, that's a huge benefit. Why wouldn't I want that? But I guess the logic probably is just that you can, you know, that fourth member could cost you another point.
It's like in Fire Emblem, where you can take the maximum number of members, or you can leave more members behind than necessary and have a smaller group. But why would you do that?
It's like, I don't know. I don't care about supports. I'm like, then why are you playing Fire Emblem?
Yeah, that's it. That's Jump this week. And also Fairy Tail. So we're going to wrap things up by naming our best series and MVPs.
Didn't Inumiya Squad have four? I don't remember. Well, beyond Inumiya himself, who's really kind of like the talent of three people. So it's kind of like a five-man team when you think about it. Anyway.
I'm going to go with My Hero Academia. It was a really funny chapter. But it, honestly, it's mostly just due to slim pickings this week. I could have gone with My Hero Academia. I could have gone with maybe Food Wars. I could have gone with Black Clover. And that's really, like, it in terms of the good chapters this week.
I could see World Trigger gain it, too. It's just not a very eventful chapter, but it's still good.
It also had had some funny moments in it.
I'm going to give it to Black Clover, just because I thought the end was kind of exciting and cool. But it's, again, it's not like a strong... It wasn't like a crazy good week for, I think, any series. I think... I wish One Piece were around this week. Until I read One Piece next week, I'm like, this chapter blows! Why, Oda?
It was not really any dominant series in the poll among the audience. A couple people clearly picked Bleach as a joke.
Right until the last moment, it was actually neck and neck between My Hero and World Trigger.
That means I just broke the tie so I could see the poll.
You put it two votes ahead, so it was ahead by one right before.
Okay. All right. Fine. Fair enough, then.
But there's been a lot of votes.
Very close
Black
between
Clover.
My Hero and World Trigger. But there were quite a number of votes for Nisekoi. There were quite a number of votes for Black Clover. Quite a number of votes for Food Wars. Just not a really single standout chapter this week, unfortunately. Hopefully things will be better next time. In the meantime, MVPs, I'm going with Ikoma from World Trigger. I really like him so far. It was a funny joke.
Part of me wants
to say Tokoyami.
Part of me wants to go Tokoyami because it's so funny, but you know what? I think I'm going to go with Tsukishima because that introduction, that revelation of what he did is so memorable and amusing to me that I think it's worthy of the pick. It's kind
For
of
all
ironic.
The wrong reasons.
All the wrong reasons. But god damn it, did I fucking... It was like, that is the biggest thing anyone could have done this week because it's the dumbest thing they could have done.
Not since Asuka Naklavar was actually cool months before.
This is the second time Bleach has gotten a character MVP. Only one time, Mo and Irony.
Oh, God. All right. So, that's going to do it for this week of Weekly Manga Recap. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We record the show on hitbox.tv/reloadc every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes that plan does need to change a little bit, so keep following us on social media so that we can keep you updated on what we're going to do to record the show. On Twitter, he's at RoloT. I'm at YRuler of Time. We are at WMR Podcast. And follow those things. We'll let you know when and where we're starting the show. You can also check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, as well as our YouTube channel, and on iTunes. If you subscribe to us on iTunes, you can leave a comment, you can leave a rating, you can help us beat the woodworking podcast in the hobbies section of iTunes.
I don't think we're ever going to do it, Nick.
That's all right.
We can dream. It's that moment, though, where you have to sit there and say to yourself, like, look, I know the Starks are the lead characters, but they're just not going to be happy. It's just not the world he's set up. And you just have to stop dreaming, and you can start enjoying life a little bit more. So I just have to accept that we're the woodworker's bitch, and we always will be, because our fans just don't care enough to write a 5-star review on iTunes, even though we give them so much content even every week. It's what it is.
We're down to, what, 3 Starks in snow at this point, aren't we? In Game of Thrones?
And, 4. Arya.
Arya, yeah, Sansa. Yeah, 3. Yeah. Okay. Anyhow. Weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com is our email address. You can send suggestions. You can ask us questions for our Q&A episodes, the most recent of which we just recorded last night. And, of course, you can just provide feedback on the show. We love to hear from you guys about what you think about the show. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create tons of bonus content for you guys to enjoy.
Yes. We're going to have a very cool bonus pod this month. We're going to be trying a special improv podcast, manga improv podcast, kind of like Whose Line Is It Anyway, but manga-centric topic. So I'll actually probably be reaching out to the community to get some, essentially, suggestions and ideas for some of the games we'll be doing.
Get some scenes in the hat going. Yeah.
We're going to be shooting out for that, so it'll be some good times. Also, special thanks to Graham Cannon, who is our newest Patreon supporter. So thank you very much, Graham.
And thanks as well go out to the people who help make the podcast possible. Steve Mann, our tarot card artist, as well as Infamous Planet, who made this frame that you see around us. And that's going to do it. Our next suggestion that we're going to be taking a look at... In light of the fact that we just covered a girl love series, I thought it was finally time for us to take a guy love series. A couple of people have sent this one in, one anonymously and one from Kirito Prime. It's Aitsu no Daihonme, which is the story of two guys in high school falling in love. So that's what we're going to be reading. It's also called, what is the alternate title? Because there's an English fucking title. His Favorite. That's a lot easier to read.
Okay, His Favorite. I'm seeing a lot of people saying, oh my, in the chat.
A lot of
oh my's. Oh, all right, well, hold on. Now Annalisa gave a fucking yes, my BL baby. Maybe we'll have to have Annalisa on here so we can have somebody who's like, I get this. And not me and Nick being like, it's kind of gross. I mean, not to have anything wrong with it. It's just like, one kind of looked like Chris, the other one looked like me, so not really comfortable with this.
A little bit weird.
They kept calling each other by Chris and Nick. I'm starting to think we just read a doujinsen.
You did not even pronounce that word remotely correctly.
Well, I got the entire way through the podcast pronouncing mozzarella right the entire way through, so I'm pretty proud of myself.
How did you pronounce it?
Or Maria Goglo. Whatever the name of the manga we just read was. Marionatsu? Marionette? Michelangelo? Macarena? Got it. Nailed it. Macarena.